Welcome to Your Call. Rose Aguilar is off today. I'm Angie Corgo. A new mayor is ready to take on problems that have stymied plenty of those who've gone before him, even in times when the city was rich, full, and bustling. Dan Lurie took the oath of office after a comfortable win over London Breed. Stories differ over who gave Lurie the brand of an outsider. His campaign strategist, Tyler Law, told the San Francisco Standard the label was assigned to him by the press. Wherever it originated, it seems to have helped him into office. Will it help him as he becomes the insider? We're talking this hour about what Dan Lurie's intentions are, expressed or implied, what his priorities are, and what he has said about how to achieve them. Without his having held office before, what chops is he bringing to the job? Our two returning guests have the chops to pull all this picture together for us. Joe Eskenazi is the managing editor and columnist for Mission Local, formerly writer for SF Weekly and senior editor at San Francisco Magazine. He's a past Journalist of the Year, honored by the Northern California chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Joe, hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for coming back. Also bringing many journalistic honors to the table is Tim Redmonds of 48 Hills, which he founded. He's been a political and investigative reporter in San Francisco for over three decades. He spent a long stretch of that as executive editor of the Bay Guardian. Tim, it's great to talk to you again.
Great to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's do a little bit of that background about how Dan Lurie got into office, because that may tell us a little bit about what he plans to do when he gets there. Joe, what can you tell us about his platform for the campaign?
Well, it was broad and sunny about bringing change and accountability. But the specifics were not really there. And, you know, that was fine for a campaign, because this time around, it was enough to just say, I'm not responsible for the problems you're having. And the people who are running against me are in varying degrees responsible for that. And I'll do things differently, or even I'll do things the same, but I'll be competent. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, that was it in a nutshell. Was I'm not those guys. I'm bringing a new perspective. I'm not them.
Tim, what would you say about his one big credential, which is the Tipping Point?
Well, the Tipping Point was a nonprofit organization that he founded and that he ran, that he described as an anti-poverty organization, which meant that they gave money and grants to groups that were fighting poverty. It was vastly smaller than the city and county of San Francisco, which has a budget close to $14 billion and about more than 30,000 employees. It's a big operation. The other thing about being mayor of San Francisco is, frankly, it's a political job. It's not, you're not walking in to run a nonprofit or even a business. It's a political job, and you have to deal with a lot of politics. And he has virtually no experience in that area. So that's the challenging question that he's going to be facing. He's going to have to deal with the Board of Supervisors. He's going to have to deal with department heads. He's going to have to deal with the school board, and he's going to have to deal with the state legislature. And he may end up having to deal with the Trump administration. And these are areas that he doesn't have any experience in, because he's never done politics before. That, of course, as Joe says, that was his pitch. I'm different. I'm not a politician. Look at the politicians who've been running the city, and we've got all these problems. But he's walking into a job that he has very little experience doing.
May I note, you sound a tad skeptical.
I am a tad skeptical, because I'm open to seeing him be successful, but I do think that when you are taking on the job of mayor of San Francisco, it's difficult to do if you don't have some political experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a big secret. Lurie's background is unlike the vast majority of the voters that elected him. He's an heir to Levi Strauss' fortune. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And as noted, he lacks experience in elected office. And that being said, there's a history of mayors with similar backgrounds having had similar tenures in this role, successful tenures. Lurie often pointed to Dianne Feinstein and Michael Bloomberg as precedents for how well he could do coming from outside. Joe, why don't you touch on that for us?
I mean, with all due respect, I think it's not an apt comparison. Dianne Feinstein was in government for a very, very long time, even though she came from a privileged background. And Michael Bloomberg is a self-made billionaire. On top of that, you know, Michael Bloomberg is, I don't know what language I can use on the radio, but it's going to rhyme with bass bowl. And that's fine for New York voters. New York voters want a hard charging guy like that, who's not a nice guy and a conciliator, someone who's going to bowl you over. And that's something that Mayor Bloomberg did in private life, you know, schlepping his terminal from place to place and, like, you know, almost, it's like rising from being a vacuum cleaner salesman to being the president and, of Hoover, you know, and he did that. That's not Daniel Lurie's life story, and that's fine. That doesn't make him a bad person. In fact, Daniel Lurie's appeal is that he's a decent and genuine person. And there is appeal in that, and there is worth in that. But that is not what anyone would say about Michael Bloomberg. And, you know, people will say that about Dianne Feinstein, but she was extremely demanding and also extremely versed in government.
Well, Tim, he does say that he's going to set a standard of accountability within his administration. He's going to be talking on a weekly basis, he says, to the Board of Supervisors, to everyone that is answerable to him on any level, and say, it's 8:30, it's Monday morning, I want to know where you are, what your goals are, how you stand in achieving those goals. So first and foremost, it sounds like he is asking for everyone who answers to him to be on a set schedule to accomplish what their jobs are, to bring the city back to where it needs to be. Tim, what does that bear for the future?
Well, you know, I'm reminded of the old story about Harry Truman when Dwight Eisenhower was elected president, and this may be an apocryphal story, but it's been repeated many times, that Truman, after Eisenhower was elected, said, you know, poor Ike, he comes from the military. He's going to walk into the White House and say, do this, do that, and expect things to happen. And they're not going to just happen like that. It's a complicated machinery, the city and county of San Francisco. He can bring the department heads in and he can tell them to do things. And it's the city, because of its size, moves a little slowly. You can't just change things instantly overnight by coming in and having a meeting every morning at 8:30. I will add an accountability question here that I know Joe at Mission Local has been talking about, the Standard's been talking about, we've been talking about. London Breed had a practice of running the city by text message and then deleting those text messages so that the public had no idea what she was doing. That is a violation of the California Public Records Act and the San Francisco Sunshine Ordinance, but she got away with it. Right. And as Joe has reported on this, she got away with it because she's out of office now. I would like to ask Lurie, and I will be asking him, and I think we should all ask him, if he's going to continue that practice or if he's going to be accountable to the public by obeying the California Public Records Act and making sure that the records that he creates, whether it's email or whether it's text messages, are available to the public so we can see what he's doing, too.
Joe, the power of the press can be pretty awesome, but it also has its limitations in holding politicians to accountability, as with London Breed. What can we look to with what happened with her with this text message administration that gives us some idea how Lurie might be held accountable in the future, since she kind of got away with it?
Well, it all depends on how things go and the perception of how things go. You know, we can complain about how he's not following the rules or this and that, but if people feel better or are made to feel better, it's going to be a hard argument to make. And I don't see in the material they've reached so far a by Jove, he's got it. You know, this will solve the fentanyl crisis. But if people feel safer and people feel like progress is being made, our arguments about these solutions being facile or violations of quaint public records laws will not hold much worth. It is a bit depressing, but it's not just far right Republicans that have chosen to only listen to their sphere of commenters and have exited the reality based community. That is a challenge.
I want to stay with you on this, Joe, because Tim wrote a really great article on the inaugural address, what it included and what it didn't include. And since you brought up fentanyl, Tim pointed to your reporting, the Mission Local reporting, on fentanyl, since you bring that up. Mm-hmm. It is not legal to declare a state of emergency over the fentanyl problem, but apparently that is what he intends to do. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, he's not going to flout the law, because I think, you know, this gets into a technicality that that might elude voters or the general public who just would rather, you know, not have to hopscotch over human effluvia and, you know, might feel uneasy seeing, you know, people behaving chaotically on the street. But a state of emergency isn't just saying we're prioritizing this or things are bad. It's a very narrowly defined and legally actionable term that gives the mayor vast powers to ignore the city charter, to ignore voter approved laws. So that's beyond democratic mayor. That's into democratic dictator type situation. And we've done this. And usually it was for constrained things such as earthquakes and fires, or in the case of the Tenderloin, a very, you know, limited geographical area with a limited amount of time. So what Daniel Lurie, you know, it's been very clear that you can't declare a fentanyl state of emergency, because a state of emergency has to be for something that is unforeseen and something that is new and something, you know, that, like a fire, like a terrorist attack, these sorts of things, like what's going on in Los Angeles. So what he's done is, instead of declaring a state of emergency, he is branding what he's doing the fentanyl state of emergency. Mm. And you can't see the air quotes here, but, you know, he could declare it, you know, the miracle ordinance, but that doesn't make it a miracle. That's just labeling. And, you know, I imagine you're going to get into this, but, like, you know, he has put forward, I hate to say this, if not a plan, concepts of a plan as to what this entails. And it does take you some of the way where a state of emergency would go, but it's not ignoring the laws due to an emergency. You're changing the laws. So there's a difference there. And it is misleading at best to claim that what's going forward is a state of emergency, because it's not.
That is the voice of Joe Eskenazi. He's here with us from Mission Local. Tim Redmond is here from 48 Hills, and we're talking about San Francisco's new mayor, Dan Lurie, and how he might, well, maybe show a little bit more of his hand as to what he plans to do and how, which seems to be the missing link. We're going to take your questions and your comments as well. Our phone lines are open for your city here in San Francisco. What do you want to see done? And what indications, if any, have you seen that the new mayor has at least some steps in mind as to how to accomplish that? Did you like what you heard from him on the campaign trail? Did you not? Do you expect him to accomplish his vision? We'd like to get you into this conversation. If you are a regular worker in San Francisco, but you don't live here, it's important to get your point of view as well. San Francisco business has had, well, obvious problems, especially since COVID. And what you think as someone who is here frequently is just as important. Our phone lines are open. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you prefer email, we're here for you as well. We are watching the inbox, your call at kalw.org. We already have calls coming in, and we'll get to those in just a moment. So let's talk about how his time in office is going to be judged in comparison to Breed versus the merits of his work, because, you know, Breed was on the two issues that Lurie points to, and that is the drug use primarily, and trying to get San Francisco back on track financially. Let's talk a little bit about Breed's record on that, Tim, and whether he has made a distinction as to how he would tackle those things, especially as you point out in your article about his inauguration, funding the changes for those things.
Yeah, in terms of his actual platform, he did not actually say he was going to do anything much different than what London Breed has done. I mean, she has already directed the police department to start arresting more and more people, not just for selling drugs, but for using drugs. The jail is completely packed with people who have been arrested. It's the conditions there are horrible. But she has already directed the district. She's asked the district attorney, who is very friendly with her, to prosecute people more aggressively. All of the things that he's talking about doing, she has tried to do. And it has not been a visible success in a lot of areas. She would, of course, have had to struggle with the same $700 million plus budget deficit that he's going to have to struggle with. So we haven't heard from him other than this, you know, so-called state of emergency. We haven't heard from him any specifics about what he's going to do. In fact, he delivered this to the Board of Supervisors yesterday, and I spoke to Supervisor Shimon Walton yesterday afternoon, who said, you know, he's asking us to waive all of our authority and give him all this power, but he hasn't told us what he's going to do with it. What actually is the plan? What is he actually going to do with this? So that's where it gets really tricky. What are you actually going to do different from what London Breed did, other than saying, I'm not a politician, I'm not London Breed? Now, the other interesting thing is, yes, people are concerned in San Francisco about the fentanyl crisis, and they're very concerned, and a lot of people still don't feel safe, although the statistics show that violent crime is way, way down in San Francisco. Nevertheless, we have this narrative, this media narrative that has been going on for several years now, that San Francisco is crime-ridden and unsafe. No question that those are important issues. But in his inaugural address, he didn't talk about anything else. He didn't talk about how he's going to address the affordable housing crisis, how he's going to address the fact that the state wants to see San Francisco approve and see constructed, tens of thousands of units of housing that were nowhere near close to in the next few years. He didn't discuss education. And while it's not directly under his purview, a lot of people in San Francisco are concerned about the state of the public schools. He didn't discuss that at all. There are so many things he didn't talk about. It's as if he said, okay, I am now the mayor of public safety and fentanyl, and that's what he's doing. And I feel like no matter what he does in those areas, there's a lot of other problems in San Francisco that need to be addressed that he has thus far not even really talked much about.
I'm going to stay with you, Tim, on this point, because I want to be fair and ask you to put that in the context of other incoming mayors. Is that rare for him to leave the slate sort of blank? Here's what I prioritize. Here's what I care to accomplish. And not necessarily going into details straight up front, or is that unusual?
Well, I would say that other mayors in their inaugural addresses and in their discussions have talked about broader issues than just one. I mean, that's what struck me in his inaugural address, that two-thirds of it was about drugs, crime, fentanyl, and the rest of it was about, thank you all for being here, and I'm so honored to be the mayor of San Francisco. And I have seen other mayors say, okay, we got a lot of issues that we have to address. Here's what we're going to do about housing. Here's what we're going to do about homelessness. Or at least I am promising I'm going to take on these issues. And his was really kind of a single note message. It will be interesting to see how he takes on many of the other pressing issues that are facing San Francisco.
Let me ask you about this coming in, Joe. What did you make of the inaugural address? Joe?
I'm trying to differentiate. I mean, everything that Tim said is true. He focused on the things that he focused on during the campaign. I don't expect Daniel Lurie to come in with a master plan to solve San Francisco's pressing issues, because if there was a simple solution to this, it would have been solved by now. But you're not going to be able to fund the things that Daniel Lurie wants to do if downtown remains bereft, and that is a challenging issue that nobody has really, no one's coming up with a solution to that. In fact, things will get worse because the owners of the buildings are going to ask for reassessments downward. So it's just week one, so one doesn't need to be Debbie Downer here. But at some point in time, there needs to be a differentiation from the way one campaigns and the way one governs. And this playing things close to the chest and offering broad, non-committal solutions and just saying I want to facilitate things, at some point is not going to be enough. And to talk about the fentanyl ordinance as put forward, it doesn't say what they're going to do. It just frees them up to do to basically cut the Board of Supervisors out of the arrangement by abdicating responsibility to oversee contracting. If you are one of the ascendant tech millionaires who believes the Board of Supervisors has been running San Francisco, despite the fact we've had a string of strong mayors out of the Willie Brown mold for the last 30 plus years, then that would make perfect sense. But again, like the perceptions that we are a crime-ridden, dangerous place, it doesn't match with reality. What Daniel Lurie has proposed to do so far, running on accountability, mind you, is to give carte blanche to the departments to enter into no-bid contracts, up to $50 million, an unlimited number of them. They could hire Justin Verlander. they could outsign the Giants on the free agent market with that kind of money. So I'm waiting for more details.
Understandably, yes. Well, Tim, I want to go to your article about what he has promised, even if it is minus details. He promised a number of actions, starting with public safety, which, as you acknowledge, is one of his stated priorities. He would add an additional 1,500 emergency shelter beds. He would establish a police-friendly drop-off center as an alternative to jail, and he would create a hospitality zone to increase police presence downtown. And as a final point, he plans to expand Mayor Breed's controversial program to provide those experience homelessness, mental health challenges, or substance abuse issues with one-way bus tickets out of town. Why don't you address some of that, Jim or Tim?
Yeah, well, first of all, we just graduated a class from the police academy of 12 officers.
11.
11 officers. All right. And there was, you know, great excitement.
They don't throw in the extra. It's not like a donut shop.
Yeah. I thought it was 12, but it's 11. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's not a lot of new cops. And he is promising to add an awful lot of police and law enforcement. But it's first of all, that's very, very expensive. Police are very, very expensive. He hasn't said where that money is going to come from. He has said he's going to cut everything in the city except law enforcement. But that's going to be a lot of cuts. And he hasn't really explained where that money is going to come from. And all of this talk about getting people off the streets and into treatment is wonderful. And that's what we should be doing, is we should be helping people who have mental health and substance use issues off the streets and into treatment. Again, that's very expensive and it doesn't exist, right? There is not enough, there is nowhere near enough mental health and treatment beds for a third of the people who need it, for a quarter of the people who need it. There's just not enough. And he hasn't talked at all about how he's going to fund all of that. And then the bus tickets out of town, is that program was supposed to be designed. The idea of that program was, if someone's living on the streets of San Francisco and they have family in another city, they have relatives or people who will take them in, who will help them and give them a safe place to live and some stability in life, then we'll help them go there. But that's not how it often works out. One of my reporters interviewed a unhoused person who was offered a ticket to Salinas. Was given a ticket to Salinas. So get on the bus, you're going to Salinas. He knows no one in Salinas. He doesn't know where it is and he's never been there before, right? So this concept of giving people bus tickets out of town is ripe for abuse, for just sending people to places where there is no stability and there is no one to get them and there is no one to take care of them. As I say, it's a fine idea in theory, but in practice, it's been badly abused. And basically, it's just like outsourcing our unhoused problem to other cities. And
let me add to that, Tim, that they're not trying to hide that anymore. Tim, we've both been doing this long enough to remember iterations of programs of putting homeless people on buses. And, you know, say what you will about it, it's a lot cheaper and oftentimes a better solution. Not everybody needs to live in a Tenderloin SRO. Some people do have support back where they, you know, come from or where they have friends. But as Tim points out, they're not even making the claim that they're calling family or friends and that there's somebody who's looking out for you. They just ask you if you have, any connections there, and they put you on the bus. And what's more, it's meant for people who are in the throes of a drug problem, that they can get you on that bus within a matter of hours. So this is by design. And I think that, you know, the uneasiness that we all feel is that, you know, this is exactly what Tim said. It's shipping somebody off to somewhere else, and this could be reciprocated very easily. You know, they could ship people back here. It's not
it
what San Francisco is supported to do.
It's been done, yeah.
It's been done. Yeah, so, from Nevada, they've shipped
above that. You know, saying that the claim that the city used that this is low barrier struck many of the homeless service workers that I talked to as farcical. Low barrier is a term that's being abused, like holistic or organic. You know, you don't necessarily want a low barrier program to put someone on a bus and ship them somewhere where they have no support. Mm-hmm. That can reflect very badly on San Francisco if that person does something wrong there. So that, you know, that's a problematic in and of itself. And I wrote about that at Mission Local, and all the other stuff that Tim said is true as well. We established a 24-hour crisis drop-in center several budget cycles ago. So this is not new. This is something that was done under Mayor Breed, and it has 16 beds, which, you know, this is great for the people who are there, but this is like watching those fire planes dropping retardant on the giant forest fire. It's great if you're underneath the retardant, but otherwise, you know, the problem is bigger. And I was very surprised to see that in the press release that came out from the Lurie administration, they just multiplied the 25 people it would serve a day by 365 and said it would serve 9,000 people a year. I imagine some people might go twice. I imagine some people might go three times. You know, I mean, we all read the Malcolm Gladwell article about the $1 million Murray. The people who have problems tend to monopolize resources, mm-hmm. right? So again, this is a good development, but it also can't scale because the budget for this center is somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 million to $9 million a year. And I'm not entirely sure, it wasn't clear to me, if that included janitorial and security. And if this is a locked facility, then it becomes a much different thing. So, you know, this doesn't scale, especially when you have a budget crisis.
Joe Askenazy is with us from Mission Local. Tim Redman from 48 Hills. We're talking about how new Mayor Dan Lurie's vision and plans for the city might be accomplished, what he's addressed and how, what he hasn't. And again, we have the phone lines open for you, 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Our episodes are available on our podcast page at yourcallradio.org. So if you just joined us, you can hear the whole program there. You can sign up for our newsletter while you're there. If you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Again, our phone line for that too is 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. Let us take a wee break, and we're going to come on back and talk more about new Mayor Dan Lurie here on Your Call. And we're talking about new Mayor Dan Lurie here in San Francisco and what his plans are. We've heard some of his projections about what he'd like to do, but as we're hearing from Tim Redman and Joe Askenazy, the big question is, where's the money going to come from? That's a recurrent theme in this. But in his inaugural address, Lurie mentioned that private donations are crucial to enacting his policy plans. And there are ordinances to allow large donations to be made by private donors to fund public health policies. That's in his recently proposed legislation. So, I don't know, Tim, do you find any promise there?
Well, let me talk about this on a philosophical level and on a practical level. On a philosophical level, philanthropy is not the solution to our financial crisis, nor is it a solution to all of the world's problems. I have always believed that economic inequality should be addressed with taxation as opposed to voluntary philanthropy. Set that philosophical argument aside for a second. There's not $750 million worth of philanthropy out there. Yes, he will get a few people to fund a few things, but philanthropy, you're not going to get a philanthropist to fund the drop-in center for people who are facing severe mental health and substance use crises. Philanthropists want to fund something that they can put their name on that looks glorious. The Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, right? You don't get philanthropy to fund day-to-day on the ground kind of things that government needs to do. So yeah, sure, he'll raise some money from rich people and good for him. And, you know, that is an advantage that he has, is that he, you know, he comes from a world where you can ask people for money and maybe he'll get some, and maybe that will go to some good things. And that was kind of the tipping point model. But I don't think it's a solution to San Francisco's structural budget crisis.
Well, as you note, Tim, Lurie talked in his speech about hope. And I liked the way you broke that down, because there's a touch of insincerity there. I'm quoting from your article. Lurie talked in his speech about hope, even I would say rather inappropriately quoted Harvey Milk, whose speeches, you have to give them hope, was not remotely about cracking down on drugs. Just to give that context, Tim, what was it about?
It was actually a fairly radical speech about how at that time, and remember, we're talking in the 1970s now, about how gay people were outsiders, and they were dismissed, as were, African-Americans and Latinos and many other communities. And Harvey Milk talked about basically breaking down, going after the powerful. He talked about taking on the rich and powerful and taking on the people who were marginalizing the rest of society. That's not what Daniel Lurie talked about. I encourage people to go and look at Harvey Milk's You Gotta Give Them Hope speech, because, as I say, it was very much a radical left progressive speech about insiders and outsiders and about power and people who lacked power. And as I say, that's not really what we heard from Daniel Lurie.
I want to go back to fentanyl, because an off-air caller has pointed out that it's not just fentanyl. The bigger problem here is alcohol. And I don't know how that would differ in treatment. It certainly can look different on the streets as to how people are abusing either fentanyl or alcohol. Joe, does that make a difference if you address our off-air caller about that?
Yes, it makes a big difference. People don't just snap out of a fentanyl high. or maybe high is not the right term. It takes a long time. You know, people are you know, in an acute state for quite some time. And, you know, in addition to this making people very vulnerable, it you know, it eats up resources. You know, there's someone in that bed. But the caller makes an excellent point. Yes, people are abusing alcohol. People are abusing all manner of drugs, and people are just mentally ill on the street. And that is actually what the drop-in center that that has been referenced is for. It's not just for fentanyl. So, you know, it's for all of these things. So that makes the proportion of people it could solve problems for versus the people out there even more dire. That's not to say it's not a good thing to do, but it's not a scalable solution.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Tim?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if we want to look deeply at the roots of why we have a homelessness crisis, why there are so many unhoused people on the streets, why we have so many of these social problems, I would say that the roots of a lot of this are economic inequality, are the you know, the huge gap in wealth between the rich and the poor. This is a city with, what, 50 billionaires and lots of centimillionaires and people living on the streets. And those are problems that we need to address on a national level, on a state level, and on a local level. But I have not heard Daniel Lurie once mouth the words economic inequality. He's talked about fighting poverty, but he hasn't talked about taxing the rich. He hasn't talked about looking to some to recover some of that vast wealth that's in the city to help the people who have very little or none. And you know, that's I mean, we really, it's very, very hard to address the crisis on the streets of San Francisco or of other cities without really looking at that issue of economic inequality. I mean, you know, when I moved to San Francisco in 1981, there were very, very few homeless people. There was virtually no homelessness in San Francisco. The federal government built public housing, which had a lot of problems, but those are problems that we now know how to address. The amount of money that you could get from going to the welfare office was enough to pay for a residential hotel room. And then we've seen, under a series of presidents, starting with Ronald Reagan, the complete abdication of any responsibility for urban housing from the federal government, complete abdication, and the increasing year after year after year, the vastly increasing income and wealth gap between the rich and the poor. And you know, and that is that is something that we simply have to look at and address.
Joe, that's a long way from housing first, which has been shown again and again in cities across the country. One of the best ways to address drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and mental health, give people a roof over their heads first, and they have a chance to personally tackle these challenges. Have we heard a peep about housing first?
No, that terminology, I don't believe we've heard much of, and nor have we nor have we heard what kind of treatment the people are going to get. You know, a question to ask Daniel Lurie is, are you going to be offering harm reduction treatments, which again is what the scientific community would ask you to do, but there is a very powerful cadre of people who believe in abstinence first, and perhaps even abstinence only. So that is a question. You know, if you are going to say, on the other hand, that people need housing at the expense of anything else, that may not work anymore. Housing is just too expensive to build, and takes too long. You know, at some point you need to just get people off the street, and that's why Daniel Lurie said he wants to get 1,500 shelter beds into the system in 6 months. That is a very aggressive goal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, God willing, he succeeds, but, you know, logic would tell you that he won't. And so we are all waiting to see how he will address that if he does not get to 1,500 beds. You know, I mean, like, in the same way that you shouldn't just call something that's not a fentanyl emergency ordinance a fentanyl emergency ordinance because that's what you said you'd do. You can't recreate the alphanumerical system to say, actually, it is 1,500, you know, even if it's fewer than that. So we're waiting to see what happens there, you know, if he does fall short of that goal, which, again, is a very aggressive goal.
And let me add, as Joe has reported on with great detail, when you take people who are in the throes of a mental health or substance use crisis and you put them in jail, you create conditions in the jail that are untenable. These 1,500 beds, how many of those are going to be for people who are coming off serious substance use problems and are essentially going through withdrawal? How many of those are for people who have serious mental health issues? You can't just stick people in a shelter with no support, because a lot of the people who would be going into that shelter need more than just a bed to sleep in. They need support. They need all kinds of treatment and mental health support and substance use support. And when you put a whole bunch of people in a congregate shelter, forget the fact that COVID is still a thing and people can get sick in a congregate shelter, but think about the conditions that are going to exist in that. You know, it, with 1,500 people crammed into congregate shelters, many of them going through withdrawal or mental health crises.
Well, one of the possibilities that Lurie plans to tap is, we've already mentioned that he's going to look for donations, but of course, nonprofits would play a role in this as well. And there's an interesting contrast here. In Mission Local, Sheer Liu was writing about his plan to look at contracts for nonprofits and see about writing contracts for the city's nonprofit partners that would centralize their management and oversight. And of course, Tim, you had a very different take on that. You said that the city would fund high-performing nonprofits. When Lurie said that, quote, that means his administration can decide that some community-based organizations are not performing at his standards and cut their money. That would paint a very different picture than working hand-in-hand with nonprofits.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I will say, to his credit, Daniel Lurie has a lot of experience working with nonprofit organizations. And also, you know, the folks who have been interacting with him since he's been in office and during his campaign say, look, he wants to be a collaborator. That's his nature. London Breed was not always a collaborator. London Breed was kind of a my way or the highway kind of mayor who, if you crossed her, she would no longer collaborate with you at all. And, you know, Dean Preston saw that in District 5 when he challenged her, and they basically refused to build any affordable housing in his district because she didn't want him to have a success. Daniel Lurie is not like that. He's a collaborator. However, when you look at what is high performance for a nonprofit, that's a very vague term. A lot of nonprofits in the city, a lot of community-based organizations provide services that are very hard to measure on a, you know, business school standard of, you know, A plus, A minus. Here, you know, you've got a 97 on this particular score. A lot of the services that people provide are difficult to quantify in that sort of way. And so I think that's what, you know, I'm a little worried about is, you know, will the nonprofits face standards that basically some of them simply can't live up to because that's the nature of what they do. Mm-hmm. And it's just not easy to quantify. So that's going to be a real challenge, talking about what high performance is for a nonprofit.
I want to point
less concerned about that.
Go ahead, Joe.
What I do see Daniel Lurie doing is walking into a pitched battle with labor here, because what he wants to do via these no-bid expedited contracts of up to $50 million in up to 10 years is contract out work that could have been done by unionized labor. So he's walking straight into a battle with the city's labor unions, and we'll see how that goes. Labor still, you know, draws a lot of water in this town. So I'm not saying it's good or bad, but like, you know, this is where politics is going to, you know, there's politics and politics. And I don't think that you can shame the unions into just acquiescing while hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs are rendered redundant. Mm-hmm. So we'll see about that.
You know, I do want to point out, Tim gave a tip of the hat to one of the benefits of bringing Dan Lurie in, and what qualifications he brings in as a negotiator, as someone who is reaching out beyond what London Breed did. Joe, I want to give you the same opportunity. What can we see him having the possibility of doing right from what we know about him?
I think that Tim hit on something very important there, which a lot of it is demeanor. And all of the people in government I've talked to that are even people that certainly didn't support Daniel Lurie are thrilled to see a less bellicose and less confrontational and less vindictive style of governing. No one expects Daniel Lurie to attack the interests of the constituents of a legislator that has displeased her, or him, rather. And, you know, that is an accusation that was made many times regarding Mayor London Breed. So you're dealing with somebody who, we've talked about, you know, our concerns with the legislation as it moves forward, but it's not going to be, you know, we'll see if it's rammed through in a manner that that kind of opens up its critics to cheap populism. I don't foresee that, you know. So people are looking forward to working with somebody in a more convivial and an honest and straightforward way. That's not nothing. People have to work together.
Yes, yes. I want to look at a very large picture here. San Francisco has often been beat up by Donald Trump. The way that government is structured, he has more of a pull dealing with states about funding, as we're seeing now, emergency funding for the fires. Is there any way, and I'm going to start with you on this, Tim, is there any way that with Trump working on the national level to bash San Francisco, to bash California, can what he does have any effect on the city level, or is that just beyond his purview?
Donald Trump? Oh, absolutely not. San Francisco gets about $500 million a year. I don't, not exact figure, but in the neighborhood of $500 million a year from the federal government. And that is money that Donald Trump could simply start withholding. I mean, we have a budget crisis now of, you know, $700 million. Imagine if that becomes $1.2 billion, because all of the federal money that San Francisco gets in grants for all kinds of things, in all kinds of different grants, whether it's, you know, a grant for a new fire truck or a grant for, you know, San Francisco General Hospital, or, you know, the little housing money the federal government still provides for affordable housing. There's so many different grants that we get from the federal government that could just go away overnight, practically. So, yes. Now, the other thing that Donald Trump could do is start sending ICE agents, immigration agents, into San Francisco to raid workplaces, to raid schools, to, you know, and what does, you know, what does Daniel Lurie do? We have a sanctuary city ordinance, but what does Daniel Lurie do when the ICE agents start showing up in, you know, in workplaces all over San Francisco and start hauling people out of construction sites and restaurants and trying to deport them? That is something that he has threatened to do and that he might carry through on, and that will be really, really a crisis, a terrible crisis in San Francisco. So I think that what Donald Trump could do to the city is very, very serious.
I think it's actually even worse than that, because FEMA has up to 10 years, I believe, in order to reassess the money it gave to municipalities like ours. So the city has already accepted over $200 million on reimbursements for money that we've spent. But all told, the city has spent some $415 million during the pandemic, putting people in hotels, things like that, that could be clawed back. So if Donald Trump sees fit, that money could be clawed back, money that we've already spent. So, you know, it doesn't have to be logical. You're already seeing people overtly talking about attaching, you know, political extractions to routine aid when people are, you know, with the fire. You would think, you know, in prior generations, that would have been a scandal. That's not something you're supposed to do, but now it's overt. So if Donald Trump wants to claw back, you know, money that San Francisco has already spent and been promised by the federal government, because I don't see anything keeping him from doing it other than inaction.
Joe Askenazy is with us from Mission Local. Tim Redmond from 48 Hills. Joe, let me stay with you on this thought about what bulwarks we might have about that in the structure of the city, in the structure of the government, where we have some potential to, if not fire back at Trump, at least to protect some of that money from him. Is there any setup for that?
Yeah. I mean, we are not so uniquely vulnerable with other matters as we are with the FEMA money, which can be clawed back. But, you know, San Francisco has succeeded before in preventing some of the more crass overreaches of the Trump government with some of the things that, that Tim had mentioned regarding immigration, sanctuary city, things like that. The problem this time is that they've had years and years and years to think about this, and they have a better class of operator involved now. Mm-hmm. You know, our city attorney was successful in staving off a lot of things because of, you know, we have a good city attorney, not going to say otherwise, but also, you know, the level of legal thinking and execution from the Trump administration the first time around was poor, and the stuff was sloppily written. So it's a problem, you know, and this time there are more troglodyte judges who've been put into place by the Trump administration. And they have to have better lawyers and better better operatives that that can handle these things. So it's a bigger challenge. And also, people are overtly acquiescing to the Trump administration now in our Masters of the Universe class here in San Francisco. So, you know, certainly that is a difference. I think that there's going to be more pressure to kind of make concessions and give a little bit. But, you know, I think that that would probably be a mistake because people like Donald Trump don't want a little bit of power and don't want a little bit of concessions.
Well, we probably have three listeners left. Everyone else has gone back to bed and pulled the covers over their heads. So let's give them something a little bit positive, Tim. There are statistics that show, even though the crime has been a very big topic around the city and again in the election, San Francisco's crime is now the lowest it's been in 23 years. There's a lot of very showy crime, the smash and grabs, the many broken into cars. They get a lot of press, and it's hard for some people to believe that crime overall is down. Drug overdoses are down 23% in 2024 from the year prior. So in some ways, San Francisco was already on its way to making these things better before the election. So, Tim, what accounts for those successes, and how will his policies build upon them if he's set up to do that?
Well, you're absolutely right. And one of the things that we've seen, though, is the media narrative, as Joe said earlier, if people don't feel safe, the media narrative about crime has continued. And, you know, sometimes I feel like the TV news, every tiny little bit of crime that ever happens in San Francisco is the lead on the 6 o'clock news. Plus, you have things like you have social media, you have Nextdoor, where people talk about, the exposure to every little possible crime that is happening in San Francisco is higher than it's ever been. So even though crime is down, I wouldn't have known that, 10 years ago, I would not have known that a neighbor of mine up the street left their purse in their car parked in front of their house and the car was broken into and it was stolen. Now that is, that is out in social media, it has expanded, it's everywhere. So we hear a lot more about crime, even though the number of crimes is significantly down.
And it's down an alarming amount. There were 35 homicides in San Francisco in 2024. And I'm not going to stand and tell someone who lost a loved one that that's a low number, because when things happen to you, these statistics are irrelevant. But when you're making policy, you have to look at that. And clearly, that number is low. That number takes you back to like the Camelot era, a long time ago. And even the scourge of San Francisco, car break-ins, and again, people don't report it, but the thing is, they never did. Those are lower. Everything is going down. And so what I've written is that this will benefit Daniel Lurie because reality is better. And maybe with the changing of the guard, people's ephemeral feelings will be better too. It all depends.
With the topic of social media, we're seeing a new administration come in that knew how to run a campaign. And of course, social media is a huge part of campaigns now. And they showed some facility at that. Joe, let me stay with you and ask about whether you think the very things that have put us in this over-awareness of crime, this, overarching idea of how bad it all is, does this administration have the capability to leverage social media to improve the image of the city and to improve in the eyes of the voters what's actually happening here?
Yeah. In this case, perception is reality. And if people feel like action is being taken place, even if that action isn't productive, in the long run, people will feel better about things. One of the cliches is we must do something, and this is something. While I've been underimpressed by what I've seen so far, that doesn't hold out the possibility that there could be real and substantive things coming down the pike. It's certainly within everyone's capability to do better. So I think that it's definitely within Daniel Lurie's ability and the ability of the Lurie administration in the city to turn around the perception that San Francisco is a dangerous, violent, lawless place, because it's not. So you start with that. it's helpful. There eventually will probably be a fatigue, at least locally, of these stories. And I think that, locally people indulged in this doom looperism a bit too much. And you can point out that there's a lot of bad outcomes and there's a lot of unacceptable behavior and there's a lot of lack of accountability and people overtly doing things that they shouldn't even do in secret. But that's different than saying things are worse than they've ever been. In my lifetime and in Tim's lifetime, things have been much, much, much worse. and that doesn't make things now okay, but you also have to keep things in perspective.
Yes. Tim, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, the year I moved to San Francisco in 1981, I believe there were over 250 homicides. We were in the throes of the crack epidemic, and the city was a much more violent, dangerous place than it is today. So I think Joe is absolutely right. And if we can send that message, not only to people in San Francisco, but to, you know, around the country, that San Francisco isn't, you know, it doesn't help. I mean, London Breed's doom loop and crime thing that she used to get rid of Chesa Boudin has ended up hurting her own city, hurting tourism, hurting people here by creating that mythology. And maybe Daniel Lurie can do a good job changing that.
Joe, I'm going to give you the last word. In Tim's article, he said San Francisco has long been known for its values of tolerance and inclusion. And that quote came from Lurie's inaugural address. San Francisco has a history of reinventing itself. And we've been known for not just tolerance, but a generosity of spirit. Now, does the election of Dan Lurie indicate in any way that the generosity of spirit will continue under his administration, or are we past that?
It's a difficult question because people voted for Daniel Lurie because he was different. And Daniel Lurie, actually, if you were going to take everything he says and does and distill it out and make like an IQ type number, he's probably more liberal than London Breed, though, because he's a wealthy white man and she is a black woman who grew up in extreme and dire poverty, that doesn't jibe to some people. So San Franciscans can still claim to be quote unquote liberal, but we are also facile. San Franciscans' liberalism is people want to say they're liberal as long as it doesn't affect them and as long as these concepts remain conceptual. So we've definitely moved the Overton window towards carceral solutions and locking people up and throwing people in jail and things like that. However, we are still very liberal. If given the opportunity, I'm sure we would vote and fund treatment and all sorts of things like that. But that wasn't on the ballot this time. I think you can't ignore the fact that, you know, carceral solutions, locking people up, have definitely become more popular.
And I got to interrupt you there, Joe, because we're just up against the clock here. I thank you both. Joe Eskenazi, managing editor and columnist for Mission Local. Tim Redmond is founder of 48 Hills, former executive editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. You can give us your feedback for the show, your call at kalw.org. Nina Kissinger helped to produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Angie Coro. Thank you for joining us on Your Call.